How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. 95% of what we think, feel, and believe operates beneath our awareness. And much of it was formed long before we had the language to understand it. Today we explore the concept of the subconscious mind, how our childhood coping mechanisms quietly shape our adult lives, and why so many of us feel like we're living on autopilot. Holly McNeil is known as the Mindfulness Architect, a former global healthcare architect who once managed billion-dollar projects designing hospitals and systems to support human life in her 20s and 30s. But behind the scenes, there was a quiet unravelling. At just 7 years old, Holly experienced a moment that would shape her inner world in ways she wouldn't fully understand for decades. And at 34, despite having everything society tells us we should want, her world imploded. What followed wasn't a breakdown, but a breakthrough. A 20-year journey through neuroscience, psychology, quantum physics, and Zen Buddhism that would ultimately lead to a simple methodology that reshaped her approach to the architecture of the human mind and what it truly means to come home to yourself. Hello, Holly. I'm so grateful you agreed to share your wisdom and story with me. What do you remember about your childhood and the way it set you up for life?
It doesn't take much to change the trajectory of a child's life. You know, when we're born, we have 360-degree personalities. The world is our oyster. We're curious. We're open. And it doesn't take much to change that. And when I was 7 years old, and this is something that happens to at least half of the people in America, I walked in to see my mother crying in the laundry room. And I asked her what was wrong. And she said, without a moment's hesitation, your father has asked for a divorce. He doesn't love us anymore. And in that moment, Kim, my world shattered. He was my hero. He saved me from drowning. He was my rock. And all of a sudden, he didn't love me anymore. I was flawed. I was unlovable. And that was a pivot point.
When you realized that he had removed himself from your life, how did that impact your relationships moving forward?
You know, I didn't really realize what was happening until I hit a really low point. From that moment on, I was just trying to fix it. I was just trying to fix it, that huge hole in my heart. I tried to fix it with my stepfather, who was abusive, which made it worse, and also brought in shame and disgust into my repertoire of who I was, into the identity I was creating through our habits and patterns. And so I was just in fix-it mode until I hit what's now being called the quarter life crisis in late 20s and early 30s, when I was in such a low point. I thought, how did I get here? So for the longest time, I just thought it was normal to wake up anxious every day, to, you know, to berate yourself, to look in the mirror and see ugly. It can really be damaging for young children when they don't understand how their mind works. So I know now, I can see it now, how it definitely affected me, but I didn't know for a very long time.
When did you realize that what your mother had said to you was actually incorrect and the relationship between her and your dad was what had actually caused the breakdown and it had nothing to do with how he felt about you?
You know, it takes a long time to get to that point because sometimes we go on autopilot. We don't even know that we're feeding that habit over and over and over. It took me 20 years to crawl out of that once I hit that rock bottom. And when I asked for something better and I believed there was, things started showing up. Books, you know, Stand Up for Your Life by Cheryl Richardson, You Can Heal Your Life with Louise Hay, There's a Spiritual Solution for Every Problem. And every time I had a question, there was an answer. And it took me, actually it was in college before I hit the low point still, that I had a counselor that said, I had been date raped, and so I went to talk to her about it. And after that discussion, we started talking about my childhood, and I told her about my father and how he had left. She said to me point blank, you know, that wasn't your fault. That was your mother. Maybe your dad isn't as bad. So mom kind of kept us, we were alienated from him. So he was horrible and he was terrible. And she was just using us to protect herself from her own pain. And my counselor said, maybe your dad wasn't so bad, you know. And I actually went home that day and called my mother and confronted her about all that had happened and what she had done and what she had said and how it affected me. And then her husband, my stepfather, and what he had done. And all she could say at the end of the line was, I know you needed to vent, dear. I'm glad you could do that. No apology, no understanding, no responsibility. And I knew in that moment that it was my responsibility to bear. But I was at that point, that was 10 years before my low point. So it takes this journey from autopilot and habitual reactivity to awareness and clarity is an unraveling of all that conditioning. And these days there's a lot more about that. But for me, it was a long road, but still very grateful to be here. And there wouldn't be much I would change at this point.
That's wonderful to hear, because as a young woman, I went looking for someone who would love me unconditionally, who would be there for me. So I understand everything you've just shared with me, and I'm deeply honored that you felt you trusted me enough to share that. Because your father was taken from you, how did that impact you seeking male approval? Because you mentioned the date rape, and we're so vulnerable and exposed at that age looking for that love.
Yeah, actually, when my stepfather came into the picture, I thought, you know, he will love me. He's gonna make me whole again. And sometimes at night I would crawl in bed next to them to feel safe. And one such night, after my mom had fallen asleep, he pulled me close, you know, leaving me more confused about fathers and love and touch. And so I kept marrying my mother, actually, you know, until just recently, actually. I'm almost 60 now. Did I realize that, you know, that kindness I never gave myself, that love I never gave myself. And so I kept marrying people who couldn't give it to me either. So now I'm on my own and really going inward. And whenever I feel those things come up, I meet them with the light of awareness. And, you know, those patterns, when you can recognize them in the light of awareness, they can't sustain, right? But for so long, it took me a long time, and I made some poor choices. Again, the world isn't here to make you happy. It's here to wake you up. So I learned from all of these things. And the only regret I have is my children being in the middle of my first divorce, but they're on their own journey. So.
How many children do you have?
I have two boys, 28 and 30, and my second son is getting married in 2 weeks. So
that's an exciting time of life when your own children are going out into the world and creating their relationships that bring another layer and another level of joy and parenting, you know, into our lives. What are your hopes for your boys?
Actually, it was I that was alienated from them for a while. There was an 8-year battle, and I knew, having experienced alienation, the loss of my father, I knew what my alienation would mean to them. So I stayed in that battle for 8 years, and it was hell. And it was police episodes, and it was court cases. And every time the kids would go, eventually I did get custody, but he just worked as much as he could to break that apart. And he was eventually successful for a while. But every time the kids would leave, I would fall to pieces on the floor. And each time I picked myself up, I would see things a little bit differently. So, you know, for my boys, I see now the journey that life can be when you can get out of that chaos in your head. And at one point, as a childless mother, while I was alienated, I made the choice that if I couldn't be there day to day to raise them, that I would live by example. So I moved to the greater New York City area. I practiced Buddhism for 5 years. I moved across the country to live in a Dharma house. And yeah, I'm so thankful. It makes me tear up every time I talk about it. I have a great relationship with my children today. And so I just want to live by example. And then the rest is their journey to take.
I love that. And you mentioned, you know, well, we can't be responsible for our children through the entirety of their life, because at some point they need to stand up and take responsibility for themselves. And we've done our job. And unfortunately, that's usually the early years. You mentioned studying and, you know, healing yourself and going inward. You spent 20 years studying neuroscience, psychology, quantum physics, the Buddhism, which you just talked about, and mindfulness. Why did you feel you needed to go on this deep dive?
You know, when I first asked life, God, Buddha, universe, give me another chance and I'd do better, I didn't know the direction. I didn't know what better was. I didn't know how to get there. But like I said, having made that vow and keeping it, things started to show up. And it was about 10 years in, I started on the spiritual end of things. And it was about 10 years into my journey in 2009, so maybe 8 years in, that I realized I had something to say. So I started, you know, tracking and writing. And in my early 40s, I put two intentions out to the world. The first was to retire from my profession as an architect before I turned 50. And the second was to have the time and space to write about what I've learned. It was an intention to be a 20-year journey, but it started right around 9/11. And when we were all sequestered in our homes, I saw the last piece of the puzzle come into view. And I printed out a book proposal for a book I've yet to publish. And looking over the pages, I could see the path.
Writing and journaling is always something we're encouraged to do in that discovery. That next step, though, is sharing what we've learned with others. So how do you share this wisdom and knowledge you've gleaned over this entire experience?
It's been so interesting, Kim. I've learned to trust life, the universe. And there's been a lot of things I've tried and, you know, it's kind of slammed in my face. I'm currently doing, but things have shown up as well. Like I have a podcast, which I'm going to sunset over the summer. That's doing very well. And I love to reach out to pretty much who I want to talk to, and they'll talk to me. I'm going to conferences. This year, I'm starting to go to conferences. I'm going to the Society for Effective Sciences conference. And my work is about building that bridge from autopilot habitual reactivity through the neuroscience, psychology, quantum physics, lived experience, Buddhism, and ancient wisdom. I'm also speaking at the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and I hope to speak at the Women's Spirituality Conference this year. And then I don't know, whatever shows up, I'm here to serve the present moment. So I'm fortunate enough to have that capacity to do that. So I may work on my book next year. I may publish that. I do some coaching, but my big thing is just teaching what I know. As an architect, my job was to take the thousands of systems, the millions of pieces, work with hundreds of consultants and in-house staff to create a set of documents that complex structures could be built from. So now I teach, you know, I've used those same skills to bring together this set of practices, this safe container for unraveling that conditioned self and finding what lies underneath.
Something you just said triggered this thought in me about humans and about how change seems so difficult. I'm wondering why change feels like that for many of us in relation to our childhood conditioning.
So we tend as humans to stick with what we're familiar with. So the Tibetan word gom for meditation in Tibetan gom means to become familiar with. So a lot of times we're on autopilot. We don't even know what we're reinforcing, but change is scary because we're not used to it. We're not familiar with it. And so you are going, and your brain is meant to keep you safe. And it does so by keeping those those habits and patterns in place. It creates these laws of transformation that any new idea must pass through. And if it doesn't meet the standards, it's often altered or rejected. And so your brain is going to say, no. So you will, when anyone out there goes to change, just know that you will meet that resistance. And that is part of the journey.
You actually have a practice that I read about, thanks to Ostra Putnina, who does a podcast, and you spoke with her, and you call it the 1 minute practice that changes everything. So can you share that with me?
Sure. So my container is called Per Love, Pledge to Make the Habit of Watching the Mind, Evaluate What You Find There, Recognize When It Comes Up in Your Daily Life, Locate the Space in Between the Thoughts, Emotions, and Feelings, Open Your Heart, Invest in What You Find There, and Expand Beyond Your Conditioned Limits. But this, what you're talking about is the pledge, pledging 1 minute, 6 times a day. It's attention by design. When if you do, a habit is formed by repetition. So if you, for 1 minute, 6 times a day, you just stop and you just watch moment to moment, non-judgmental but curious awareness. And if you do that day after day after day, you're just watching the mind so that you can see what's going on. Eventually, there'll come a time when you'll notice, okay, it starts to happen automatically. You start to see your thoughts, which is the beginning of everything. Without that habit of watching the mind, without, which is what mindfulness is all about, you're always on autopilot. You're always in that reactive mode. So it's very simple, you know, and anyone can start there, but it takes consistency.
Is it the same principle as every other change of habit, which can be 8 weeks?
Yeah. It's exactly. Your mind is habit-based, and it does not discriminate between good and bad conditioning. So we have a choice. We can create new habits. So yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're creating the habit of watching the mind, creating new neural pathways that says, all right, pay attention to what's coming up, how you're reacting to it, and then start to question those things. Is this healthy? Is this serving me anymore? Is this outdated?
Love that. And we see this when we have these New Year's resolutions, which I gave up this year. Was my thing was, I'm not setting any New Year's resolutions. I'm going to do the best that I can to be the best I can be. And I'm wondering, like, what happens in that 8 week period if we do fall off? You know, how do we recover? And what have we actually taught ourselves in the period we were focused?
Yeah. So people will probably fall off because the mind is going to say, you know, this is stupid, this isn't going to work, or, you know, get you distracted so that you forget. And so kindness, compassion, understanding that, yes, I'm going to maybe fall off 5 or 6 or 18 times before I do this. But it's really, like you said, Kim, the intention. If you really want to change, you will stick with it. You can write yourself notes And if you miss a day, start the next day. And eventually, if you do it enough, it's guaranteed. It's how the mind works. You will start to see your thoughts. And that's the first step to clarity.
Any parent will know it's one of the most difficult jobs, especially when we have children in that period you described as that quarter life crisis, which was me and probably you as well. And that has impacts, right? So what can you share with people to understand that what they've been through is what they're left with? And if you cannot change the past, what can we do to change the future?
Yeah, well, there is only the present moment, right? So first of all, stop worrying about the past and what's going to happen in the future. But again, this is a quote from Eckhart Tolle, but the world is not here to make you happy. The purpose of your struggles is to have you look at it, to have you say, wait a minute, to have you let it go, to accept it, to surrender to it, and not to fight with it, because then that space starts to open up. And yeah, people have been through struggles, and it could be, I was 34, and I'm not quite 60 either yet. And life will throw you struggles. I mean, even when you become more aware and awake, But the whole journey, the human journey, is to look at those things and to understand that this is not, I mean, when you were born, I mean, we don't even have thoughts for the first 6 months. You weren't named Kim. I wasn't Holly until that was given to me. So there is a calmness, a peace, a permanent, an understanding, an unconditional love underneath all of that. And so it's never too late. Some people, you know, and it's okay if you don't get there in this lifetime, but showing yourself the kindness and starting today, step on the path and the path will appear anytime.
That is the best advice. And I know it worked for me last year. My daughter had to remind me it's one foot in front of the other. And she literally told me to get out and go walking to lift my spirits and to get back in my body because I was in my head. So
yeah,
that one step in front of the other, that works every time. Holly McNeil, it's been an absolute joy hosting you today on What We Teach Our Children. Thank you so much.
Yes, Kim, I appreciate you reaching out. And yes, I'd love to be on your podcast again. Congratulations. I hear you're up for an award for your work here. So honored to be a part of that.
Mindfulness architect Holly McNeil. In a world that constantly tells us to do more, be more, achieve more, Holly offers us a quiet and calm alternative. Just pause. Notice the small things around you and become more aware of that inner programming. When we begin to observe our thoughts, rather than be driven by them, we create space for them. And in that space, we find choice. We're not broken, we're simply operating from patterns we didn't consciously choose. And with awareness, compassion, and practice, those patterns can change. 1 minute at a time, 6 times a day. If this conversation resonated with you, I invite you to sit with all it means. Maybe the place we're all trying to reach isn't somewhere out there, it's right here, within. It's been fabulous having your company today. I'm Kim Clyden. All my contact details are in the show notes. If you'd like to connect, reach out, please. I'd love to hear from you. Sometimes you think you're speaking into a void, but it's so nice to remember there's a human being on the other end. Until we're together again, let's be the change we want to see in the world. Thank you.